Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Speck. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Nadia Hijab, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, speaks on Palestinian-Israeli peace, an agenda for the next president. Born in Syria to Palestinian Arab parents, Nadia Hijab grew up in neighboring Lebanon, where she earned a BA and MA in English literature from the American University of Beirut. During her years of study in Beirut, Hijab worked as a journalist, but eventually left Lebanon in 1975 after the onset of the Lebanese Civil War. She traveled first to Qatar and then London, where she became the editor-in-chief of Middle East magazine and appeared frequently in the media as a commentator on Middle East affairs. In 1989, she moved to the United States, where she spent several years working for the United Nations Development Program in New York City. After working there until 2000, she worked as a consultant for a variety of organizations and institutions, including the World Bank, UNICEF, and Columbia University. Hijab is a frequent commentator on the media, including BBC World and PBS's NewsHour. Authoring over 100 academic articles on a variety of subjects, Hijab's first book, Woman Power, The Arab Debate on Women at Work, was published by Cambridge University Press in 1988, followed in 1990 by Citizens Apart, a portrait of Palestinians in Israel. In 2006, Hijab joined the Institute for Palestine Studies as a senior fellow. The Institute is an independent, nonprofit research organization established to promote a better understanding of the question of Palestine. The Institute's Journal of Palestine Studies, co-published with the University of California Press, is considered a leading resource on the Arab-Israeli conflict. On Friday, October 10th, after visiting with students at West High School in Anchorage, Nadia Hijab spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council on Palestinian-Israeli peace, an agenda for the next president. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Senior Fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, Nadia Hijab.
Thank you very much for that lovely introduction, and I now feel that you know me better than I know myself almost, gosh. But it's a real pleasure to be here with you today and to be in Alaska, and my friends and colleagues back in D.C. are thrilled that I'm here because they want me to give them the lowdown on everything to do with Alaska when I go back. As you know, it's in the news and very much the focus of attention. So, in my remarks, I want to first, before I turn to what the next president should and shouldn't be doing, I want to briefly discuss how far we've come towards peace between Palestinians and Israelis, why we haven't been able to achieve peace yet, and then turn to what the next president can do about it. So I'm quickly going to look at the origins of this conflict. And the reason I'm doing that is because this is how people in the region look at the problem. They don't look at it as something that happened yesterday. They all pretty much know the history of the conflict, although they have probably different, very different narratives of how the conflict started and developed. Also, if we don't look at the origins of the conflict, we won't be able to see where we started and how far we've moved. And finally, we need to understand the past and where people are coming from to be able to work towards the future. So the first thing I usually clarify is the Palestine problem did not begin with the Palestinians. It began as a Jewish problem because the Jews in Europe did not feel empowered. There was a lot of anti-Semitism and they felt constantly under attack, well, in some cases, because in some cases they were very assimilated and integrated. But the anti-Semitism, together with the fact that Europe was developing its nation states, led to the birth of the movement that we know as Zionism, which decided to try and establish a national home for the Jews somewhere, and they chose Palestine. So then we have the British and the French at the turn of the 20th century dividing, this is in the sort of early 1900s, dividing the Middle East between them, carving up the Ottoman Empire into nation states. So many of the states in the Middle East are actually quite new nation states. And we have Britain promising the Jews a national home in Palestine. Now, Palestine was at that time, around the turn of the century and for centuries before, a very populated place with highly developed urban and rural economy. And I've brought you here a sample copy of one of my favorite books of the Institute for Palestine Studies called Before Their Diaspora, which describes very much the people, the schools, the churches, the mosques of the Palestinians, and the rural economy. And I would like to leave this as a gift for the World Affairs Council, but feel free to order your own copy, of course. There are order forms on the table and a bunch of other literature that I've put out on the table. So you had a situation where Britain began to allow Jewish immigration to Palestine. The Palestinians resisted, and you had for the first time ever conflict between the Arabs and the Israelis in Palestine. Moving fast forward to the 1947 partition plan, which is when Britain got tired of the problem and dumped it on the United Nations. You had the UN suggest the partition of the country as something that the Palestinians did not feel was just. And so the first Arab-Israeli war broke out. 700,000 Palestinians became refugees. And that led to a series then of wars between the Arabs and the Israelis. I'll just highlight, of course, the 1967 war when Israel occupied what was left of Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. So today, Israel controls all of historic Palestine. Now, where did we begin, if you like, to move towards peace in the way that people think about it, the contours of a peaceful settlement or a settlement between Arabs and Israelis today? That really began just after the 1973 Arab-Israeli war in October, which saw a partial Arab victory in that war. So this began a shift in the program of the Palestine Liberation Organization from an aspiration and a dream to liberate all of Palestine for the Palestinians to a recognition of realpolitik. They saw that the Arabs had been partially successful. They recognized that that was probably the limit of what the Arabs could do. Egypt was moving towards a peace treaty of its own with Israel. And so the Palestinian Liberation Organization began to indicate that it would accept a two-state solution, i.e. that there would be a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza and an Israeli Jewish state in the rest of Palestine. So they declared this purpose in 1988. They said that they would go for a Palestinian state. And this was the culmination of a huge shift in the Palestinian national program. And it was a pretty large concession, which is giving up 78% of their country, of Mandate Palestine, what had been their country, and accepting to have a state in 22% of Palestine. So then we have the first Gulf War in 1991, which led to the Madrid peace process, where for the first time Arabs and Israelis all sat around a table and talked peace together. So by the early 90s, we had come very far from where we were in 1948 when Israel was created, to a peace, the concept of peace based on two states. Now, why haven't we been able to achieve peace? I think the moment that there were maybe two moments where we could have achieved peace. One was with the Madrid peace process, but that was sidetracked when the first Bush administration was not reelected. And then in 1993, ironically, when the first accord, the first agreement was signed between the Palestinians and Israelis at what was known as the first Oslo Accord, and it was signed on the White House lawn, of course, as you know, here in the States, that kind of set the pattern for three things that really tell us why we don't have peace today. The pattern that was launched then, not that anybody knew that this was the pattern that was being launched, but the pattern that we saw since then was agreements reached but never being implemented. I mean, so after 1993, the Israelis and Palestinians signed something like 12 agreements, all collectively known as the Oslo Accords. The Palestinians thought, okay, you know, we've given up 78% of our land. You know, now we're going to get our state in 22%, and Israel is going to withdraw the settlements and settlers that had begun to put into the occupied territories, and it's going to withdraw them, and we will have our state. That didn't happen. None of the agreements really got implemented. The last agreement is something known as the roadmap, which is supposed to be performance-based and sequenced so that you have confidence-building measures between Israelis and Palestinians. You know, Palestinians would take some actions on security. Israel would do something to improve freedom of movement for the Palestinians, and slowly you would build confidence and move forward. Well, nothing's happened on the roadmap since 2002. We're 6 years down from the roadmap now. So that was the first part of this pattern, agreements that don't get implemented. Second part of this pattern is a whole plethora of meetings, lots of pomp, lots of circumstance, you know, world leaders meetings, Israelis and Arabs meeting, Palestinians and Israelis meeting, but nothing happens. And the most recent of these meetings is the Annapolis conference that the U.S. Shepherded at Annapolis in 2007, where you had something like 50 representatives from world countries, world leaders from all over the place, pledging to commit to peace and achieving peace by the end of this year on the basis of a two-state solution, a Palestinian state side by side Israel. Nothing happened. Finally, the third aspect of this pattern is really implementation mechanisms that don't work. The quartet, which is a grouping that came together to push the roadmap, where you have Russia, the United States, the European Union, and the UN all sort of supervising, monitoring, and supposedly pushing the roadmap, hasn't really worked. And 21 aid agencies just last week issued a really damning report about the quartet. They said in all of the areas that the quartet had identified as key for the process, the situation has actually either deteriorated or stagnated. You know, so things have got worse, not better, with this quartet. And that includes really some of the top aid agencies like Oxfam and CARE and Save the Children. So they highlighted especially settlements, lack of freedom of movement and access to the outside world for the Palestinians, and the siege around Gaza. So why has this pattern developed and remained in place? And I think really as the Palestinians moved from, if you like, a maximalist position of we want it all, we want our home back as it was, to the center, you had the Israelis moving to a maximalist position. We want to keep as much of the land as we've occupied, and, you know, with as few of the people. So in fact, and these are all pretty well documented facts, during the Oslo peace process, the number of settlers, I mean, during the actual peace process negotiations between 93 and 99, between the Israelis and Palestinians, the Palestinian land and economy was squeezed. And the number of settlers, Israeli settlers in the West Bank, doubled from 93 to 99, from 200,000 to 400,000. Gaza became cut off from the rest of the world, not as we think when Hamas was elected to government in 2006, but actually the siege around Gaza was almost completed and in place by the early 1990s. East Jerusalem, Arab East Jerusalem, which had been occupied by Israel and annexed after the 67 war, was cut off from the West Bank. Palestinians found it very hard to get from the West Bank to East Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem is actually the cultural, economic heart of the West Bank. So that was cut off. And the Jordan Valley, which is on the edge of the West Bank, between the West Bank and Jordan, which has very fertile land, also became off limits. Israel made that off limits to the Palestinians. So this was happening during the peace process. And that's why I say that as the Palestinians move towards a compromise, I have a sense that the Israelis moved away from a compromise based on a two-state solution. Even so, even after all this settlement and loss of land by the Palestinians, there was a moment still in the late 2000-2001 where we might have had peace based on a two-state solution. The Palestinian-Israeli negotiators met in Egypt in 2001 to look at, in January 2001 to discuss parameters that President Clinton had put out for peace, and they said in a joint statement that they'd never been closer to coming to an agreement, that they had discussed core issues, refugees, the return of the Palestinian refugees, security, borders, and Jerusalem. These are all the tough core issues of the conflict, and they'd made substantial progress. Unfortunately, Sharon was elected at that time. Of pretty much any Israeli, he's done most, I think, to push the settlement movement and to colonize Palestinian land. And he actually, after his election, also began the construction of the wall that cuts way into Palestinian territory. It was put forward by Israel as a security measure, but in fact it cuts way into Palestinian territory and it separates Palestinian towns and villages from their fields and from each other. And the settlements continue to this day. They've never stopped. And if you want to understand the extent of the changes that Israel has made to the West Bank, I suggest that you go online and take 5 minutes to look at a PowerPoint that was developed by the Office for the Coordinator of the Humanitarian Affairs, the UN Humanitarian Office in the West Bank, and it's ochaopt.org. That's ochaopt.org. And you can see a PowerPoint called Fragmentation of the West Bank. It's very short, and what it shows you is how the Israel's occupation infrastructure is superimposed on a map of the West Bank. So first you have the 149 Israeli settlements, and then you have something like what is now 500,000 settlers, and then you have 27 military bases, and then you have nature reserves, and then you have tunnels and checkpoints and obstacles and Israeli-only roads. And by the time all these overlays are on the map, the Palestinian areas that are left look like just slivers of flesh, you know, hanging off a skeleton. So that's what the West Bank looks like today. So that's where we are today. Those two promising moments for peace were never realized, and here's where we are today. Now, what do we see happening from now on? Israel is very strong on the ground, and it has one of the most powerful militaries in the world. But it's weak in other ways, and it's important to understand that. One of the ways that Israel is weak is that the settlement movement that was nourished and pushed by the entire Israeli establishment, left or right, the political parties, is now too strong for them to control. The settler movement has become very strong in the army, and it's become dangerous not only to Palestinians. So the settlers are not only attacking the Palestinians, but now they're also attacking Israeli soldiers, and they've started attacking Israeli Jews. Ironically, Israel has built the wall to protect itself, so it says, from Palestinians in the West Bank. But, of course, the settlers can move anywhere. And they most recently attacked, about 2 weeks ago, they attacked an Israeli Jewish professor using a pipe bomb outside his house, because he opposed the settlements. So that's a very dangerous situation there. So that's one challenge that Israel really faces. A second challenge that Israel faces is that its legal situation is untenable. According to international law, colonizing an occupied territory and changing its nature is illegal. And so pretty much all the actions Israel has taken in the West Bank and in Gaza are illegal. So the only party or body that could make Israel's or some of Israel's settlements legal is the Palestinians by signing off on them. But for the moment, they're illegal. And that illegality was recently reaffirmed by the International Court of Justice, which was asked to give an advisory opinion on Israel's wall that Israel is building in the West Bank. and reaffirmed that the wall is illegal, said Israel should dismantle it, said it should pay compensation. And also the International Court of Justice said that no other country should support Israel's illegal wall and its associated regime of settlement. And that has implications for countries that do support that, like the United States, which doesn't support it formally, but by giving aid to Israel, to the extent that that aid is siphoned off or channeled to the settlement project, that's in violation of international law. So the settler movement is too strong, the legal situation is untenable. Then Israel's moral situation is untenable, and this is something that many Israeli Jews have been speaking up about. They are worried because people are beginning to refer to the situation in the West Bank as an apartheid regime that is similar to that in South Africa. And several Israelis, including Ehud Olmert, has warned of Israel being referred to as an apartheid state if it does not withdraw from the West Bank and enable a Palestinian state. Interestingly, Ehud Olmert, even though he says things like this, the pace of settlement construction doubled under his premiership. I mean, he makes these dramatic statements, and now he's made a very dramatic statement where he said, look, we know we're going to have to give it up. We're going to have to give up most of the West Bank, and including East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, to have a peace agreement with the Palestinians. But he said this on his way out of office. Then another problem, actually, for the Israelis is that the Palestinian leadership is now extremely weak, and it's been weakened largely as a result, well, partly as a result of its own policies, but also largely as a result of Israeli policies, because the fact that Palestinians can't move, that their economy is a mess, that they have no hope for the future after 40 years of occupation, you know, is something that doesn't make them look favorably on their leadership. And that means that there's no one to really strong enough to sign a peace agreement with Israel should things move that way. Now, Arafat, the late Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat, he had the authority to make the Palestinians make that huge compromise and go for a two-state solution. To have a peace agreement, you're going to need another Palestinian leader to compromise, to ask the Palestinians to compromise on the question of the return of the refugees. But the fact that the leadership is today so weak, they I don't think they could get away with such a compromise. And of course, as the traditional Palestinian leadership has weakened, Hamas has got stronger. So here's that's the situation that the next president will face. What should he do or not do? But first, can he afford to ignore the Middle East? And I would say no, because, and this is not just my opinion, but U.S. leaders and thinkers have repeatedly said, including, and this includes a bipartisan report that you probably know of, the Iraq Study Group, it includes former President Jimmy Carter, includes the International Crisis Group. They all say that the problems of the Middle East, the problem in Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran, cannot be solved without tackling the Arab-Israeli conflict. So they consistently reaffirm that. Also, polls of Arabs and Muslims consistently show that the U.S. policy they most dislike is its unquestioning support for Israel. I mean, over and over again, there are polls in the Arab world and Muslim world that reaffirm this. So what should the next president do? First of all, he needs to insist that Israel take on the settler movement and push and help Israel, both push Israel and help Israel to take on the settlement movement so that the settlements are finally frozen and rolled back from Palestinian land. And the next U.S. president should make it difficult. He can do this by linking U.S. aid, which is quite considerable, to Israel, to action on the settlements. He can also do this by making it very difficult for private groups there are a number of private groups in the States that actually end up sending money to the settlement enterprise. That's the first thing. The second thing, the U.S. should stop weakening and start strengthening the Palestinian leadership. The U.S. has played an active role in weakening the Palestinian leadership, for example, by stopping unity agreement between Hamas, the Islamist movement, and Fatah, the traditional leadership. And that's been very well documented in Vanity Fair, if anyone wants to read that, and in a confidential report by a high-level UN representative to the region, Alvaro de Soto, about the U.S. role in sort of torpedoing that attempt at Palestinian unity. So the next president really has to help the Palestinians, or at least not stand in the way of the Palestinians, reunifying their leadership. And the only way to do that is to bring in Hamas. And Hamas has actually said publicly on TV that what it wants is a two-state solution. Hamas actually no longer has any kind of maximalist agenda. It's part of the Palestinian mainstream. And interestingly, it can achieve a ceasefire with Israel that holds. There is a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel now in Gaza that's holding. Then the next president should really bring in Arab actors to enable compromise, to enable the Palestinians to compromise, because they're going to need protection as they move towards peace. And the U.S. should bring in international actors, especially the Europeans, to enable Israel to compromise, because Israel is going to have to compromise moving towards peace, and they're going to be taking risks, and they will need protection. I think what the next president must not do is don't start a new negotiating process. Negotiations have been going on since 1993. You know, we've had negotiations almost for 16 years. Everyone knows what a two-state solution will look like, and what is needed now is to implement it. The next president should not have any fancy conferences or meetings. That's been done repeatedly. Everybody, as I said, including the Israelis, and Ehud Olmert said so in his interview most recently, knows what the contours of a peace would look like. The U.S. must not keep the European Union out of the process. It's very important for the U.S. to share some of the burden with the Europeans and let the Europeans take the blame for failure if there is to be a failure, or at least share the blame for failure if there is to be a failure, so the U.S. is not there alone, you know, in the eyes of the world as responsible for peace in the Middle East or failure of peace in the Middle East. And I don't think the U.S. should have or support any agreements that have confidence building or mutual steps or whatever. Again, that's repeatedly been tried, and it makes everything hang on if there's a lone person who has a gun or whatever. You know, everything hangs on security. No, have a comprehensive ceasefire that's mutually agreed by all sides, and have all sides work on that comprehensive ceasefire, and then move very quickly to begin to freeze and dismantle the settlements, release some of the Palestinian prisoners or all of the Palestinian prisoners in jail, and guarantee freedom of movement and access. So then the question is, can the president do so? Does he have the power to do so? Of course, everybody knows that the Zionist lobby in the United States is very strong. That's no secret. And of course, we know that the U.S. provides a lot of aid to Israel. It could use that aid, as I said, you know, as a lever, but one of the reasons that it doesn't is because of the strength of the Zionist lobby. But, and here's where I'm really hopeful, in fact, looking to the future, there are changes in the U.S. political map. There's a growing anti-occupation American Jewish center, as well as an American Jewish left in this country. And most recently, a new lobby has been established called J Street in Washington, D.C., to present itself by several leading American Jews, actually very respected figures. And they've joined several American Jewish groups in the center in the U.S. And they're saying that it is possible to be pro-Israel and pro-peace, and to make sure that, you know, there is a Palestinian state, that the settlement movement ends, and the settlements are withdrawn. So that's a very, very hopeful movement and hopeful sign. And I think will counterbalance the influence of AIPAC and make it possible, give the U.S. president more freedom of maneuver. All these factors that I've just mentioned are coming together in a way that will make or could make a last-ditch attempt for a two-state solution possible. Otherwise, if there isn't such a solution, I'm afraid that we will see a complete breakdown of law and order, anarchy, violence and death, which is likely to spill out, as it always does, from the borders of Israel and Palestine. So I would conclude by saying that and urging that peace is possible, that it is necessary, and that it is urgent. Thank you.
You've been listening to Nadia Hijab, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies in Washington, D.C. Recorded Friday, October 10th, at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, Hijab responded to questions from the audience following her speech on Palestinian-Israeli peace, an agenda for the next president. First, an audience member who has visited Israel said it was pretty hard for him to imagine a two-state solution. Since Israel is such a small state, complete separation would seem impossible, he said. Is a two-state solution really viable, he asked.
No, you know, that's a good question. A lot of people are asking that. And actually, a lot of Palestinian intellectuals and a lot of Palestinian just people are beginning to say, look, a two-state solution is no longer possible. So what are our options? And they are beginning to say, maybe we should go for a binational state in the whole country. You know, so say that to Israel, okay, fine, you know, you're occupying us, please go right ahead and annex us and give us equal rights. We want equal rights. We want to be citizens of Israel. And that really scares Israel because, you know, they say, oh gosh, if that happens, the number of Jews and the number of Arabs in the country will be the same. And if they don't give the Palestinians equal rights, then they definitely will be tarred as an apartheid state. But don't rule it out. A lot of Palestinians are now beginning to say we should change our strategy and go for a binational state. However, if people did want a two-state solution, there still is the space there. The settlements are illegal. I mean, that has to somehow be recognized and reckoned with. Many of them have to be, can be dismantled. They should all be dismantled. Shall we say some of them have become so much like cities that it may be hard to dismantle them? They should all be dismantled because they're illegal. But most can be dismantled. The ones that can't be dismantled, the discussions between the Palestinians and Israelis have sometimes provided for, okay, if, you know, you can keep this piece of the West Bank in exchange for that piece of Israel. But the Palestinian state would have to be completely sovereign. I mean, you wouldn't be able to have Israel controlling every aspect of Palestinian life as it does now. For example, the Palestinian population registry is in Israel's hands. Israel keeps track of who is Palestinian, who isn't, who gets residence, who doesn't, you know, who can come in, who can't. That would all have to change. There is the space. There are the resources. Both are highly educated populations. And there is a very strong sense of Palestinian nationalism, and there is now a very obviously strong sense of Israeli nationalism. So I think you could still have a two-state solution, but not for much longer.
Another audience member asked, do you see any promise in the first female Palestinian being elected to the Israeli government?
That's a very good question. You point to a different aspect because first of all, let me say that Palestinians or Arabs and Jews There are no personal issues between the two. I mean, so it's not a matter of let's just bring everybody around the table and they'll get to know that they're all nice people and they'll get along. It's not about that. I have many Jewish friends in Washington, D.C. Some of the people who are most strongly in favor of Palestinian rights are actually Jewish. So it's not about that. There really is a basis for this conflict. It's about land and homeland and a place to live in freedom and call home. So separately from Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, when Israel was created in 1948, about 100,000 Palestinians remained on their land. And they number now about 1.3 million Palestinians. And they are citizens of Israel. And so the promise I see is that there is a movement among the citizens of Israel, and this is happening quite separately from the push for, you know, a two-state solution. There is a movement among citizens of Palestinian citizens of Israel, supported by some Israeli Jewish citizens, for equal rights within Israel. And I think that will show the way for the future, not just in Israel and in a future Palestine, but also for the entire region, because we live in a world where not everywhere are citizens considered to be equal under the law. That's a challenge. I mean, some people are privileged because of their religion. Some people are privileged because of their ethnicity. This still happens in many countries around the world. And countries are still struggling with that. And when you can have a movement for equality within Israel, among Palestinian citizens of Israel, I think that's extremely hopeful. There's some very, very, there's some people that I respect very highly among the Israeli Jewish establishment that are working towards that.
Whether it's two states or two parties in one state, how is the solution complicated by the availability of fresh water? Another audience member asked.
Yeah, that's a very good question. There is very little water in the region, not just in Israel, Palestine, but, you know, throughout the region, water is at a premium. And so, as I said, the wall that Israel is building, ostensibly for security reasons, but actually well within the Palestinian West Bank, does cut off from the Palestinians the main aquifers in the West Bank. And in fact, Israel has been using that water for decades now, since it began its occupation. The Israeli settlers in the West Bank use far more water. I don't have the percentages at my fingertips, but the Israeli settlers use far more water than the Palestinians in the West Bank are available to access. So water is an issue, but that is going to involve a lifestyle change for everyone. Just like oil or access to oil is going to have to involve a lifestyle change for everyone in the United States, access to water is going to have to involve a lifestyle change for everyone in the Middle East, with people becoming much more cautious about conserving water and having agriculture that makes sense given, you know, arid climes and not much water.
Next, an audience member asked Nadia Hijab to talk more about the Palestinian refugees. Where are they exactly? He also asked her to talk more about the Palestinian population as a whole. What are some of the similarities and differences between the Palestinians and the Jews?
Okay, thanks. So when Israel was created, about 700,000 Palestinians lost their home and their lands, my mother's family among them. And the refugees ended up in Lebanon, in Syria, in Egypt, in Jordan, and a lot of them in the West Bank and Gaza. So many of the people in the West Bank and Gaza are actually refugees from the part of Palestine that became Israel in 1948. And many Palestinian refugees still live in refugee camps, and those refugee camps are in all these areas. And they're supported by the United Nations Refugee and Works Agency, UNRWA, which has helped to provide education and food and healthcare for over 60 years now. So That's where they are. And in some of these neighboring countries, they have quite a few rights, like to a passport or travel documents, or to, you know, education and health and so on. In Lebanon, the Lebanese balance, sectarian balance, Lebanon there is a mixture of communities, very delicately balanced along religious lines. The Palestinian refugees are mostly Muslim, and so the Lebanese have been trying to keep them apart from the Lebanese society, so that the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon have least rights of all. Their situation is very grim. They don't even have the right to work. So those are the refugees, and they have the right under international law to actually go back to their homes in what is Israel today. So that is a big challenge that will face any peace process. Now, in terms of similarities, many Jews are from Arab lands, and before the State of Israel was created, they would have considered themselves Arab, including those who lived in Palestine. So they have a lot of the culture, similarities in culture and food and dress and customs. But as I said, it's not an issue of people being able to get along together. It is an issue of solving a political conflict about existence, you know, who gets to exist where and how. And once that is solved, and once you move beyond the hatred, really, that's been created due to loss of land and life, in many cases, you know, people will be able to get along just fine.
The next audience member asked Nadia to list some of the Israeli groups she mentioned living in the United States lobbying for Israel.
Sure. And I think that is exciting because, you know, when you're able to talk about issues, when you can discuss issues freely, then, you know, you can develop better understanding and you can move forward. And so the American Jewish groups, whose names I will give you, and I'll start from the left and move to the center, there's a group called Jewish Voice for Peace. And that's jewishvoiceforpeace.org. And they are, as I say, on the left in the sense that they would probably support more radical measures than the American Jews in the center, including they've taken on Caterpillar over its sale of bulldozers to Israel that are used to bulldoze Palestinian homes. They are, this American Jewish group is in the lead of a campaign to stop sales of bulldozers to Israel. I really highly respect their work. In the center, you have, I guess, a cluster of about six groups. Israel Policy Forum, and ask to be placed on their listserv. Apparently, they have one of the biggest listservs in the world, they announced recently. You'll get the articles of M.J. Rosenberg. He's very articulate and very good on the issues. But they're in the center. I mean, they're by no means radical groups, and they certainly believe in Israel's. You know, I mean, so does America. So does Jewish Voice for Peace. I mean, all these groups want to see Israel continue to exist and thrive. I mean, they're not by any means anti-Israel. So Israel Policy Forum, Americans for Peace Now. Americans for Peace Now monitor the settlement movement very well. Who else is there? Something called Brichedek Vishalom. Don't ask me to spell that, but if you can, they are a more recent group, and they've been very active. And the lobby I mentioned that has just been established is called J Street, and I think we'll be hearing a lot more of them soon. There's also, I should mention, there's on the left a coalition of American groups from all ethnicities and all faiths, of something like 250 American groups that have come together just simply to change U.S. policy towards the conflict so that U.S. policy begins to oppose the occupation. And you can get more information about that group, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, at endtheoccupation.org.
In addition to the United States and the European Union working for Palestinian-Israeli peace, What is the role of the other Middle Eastern states like Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Syria?
Sure. Yeah, the Arab states have have tried to play and potentially could play a very important role. They came up with the Arab Peace Initiative in 2002, and this initiative was extremely important because it was the first time that all Arab countries, all 22 states, I believe it is, said, look, if Israel withdraws to the 1967 borders, has a two-state solution, you know, we will all, and, you know, shares East Jerusalem, we will all normalize relations with Israel. We will have normal relations with Israel, the entire Arab world, and we will have an agreed upon just solution for the refugees. The words agreed upon are pretty crucial in that peace initiative. They might slip certain people by, but what they mean is, you know, that they won't force Israel into taking back, you know, 700,000 people and their descendants. And that it would be an end to all claims. That's the Arab Peace Initiative. And, you know, they launched in 2002. Just afterwards, Sharon reinvaded the cities of the West Bank and imprisoned Arafat in his compound. But the Arab Peace Initiative was relaunched last year. And, you know, it's evidence that everybody wants this problem to end, but to end on the basis of a platform that's reasonably just, that can be reasonably accepted by majorities on both sides. You know, if that happens, Iran, of course, supports the Palestinians very strongly and supports Islamist movements in the region. But if that happens, you know, there would be nothing left to support because people would be getting on then with their lives. They wouldn't have to be struggling, you know, for their basic human rights.
Seeing that there is no J Street, can you please explain the J Street lobbyists? Another audience member asked.
Yeah, that's a good point. There is no J Street. There's definitely a K Street, though, sadly. The J Street, their idea was that just as the American Jewish pro-peace, pro-Israel voice is invisible just like J Street is invisible, you know, and they want to make it visible. So it's a bit comic, basically, a bit abstract, but that's the thinking behind it. And you know, they've got some pretty powerful people on their board and respected people working on this. And I think we'll just I was speaking to one of their members a couple of months ago, and you know, they said they want to wait until the new president is elected. Nobody's going to do anything different from, you know, walk very carefully down the line of the accepted discourse at the moment on the Israel-Palestine question. But as soon as the new president is elected, they're going to move fast to get a different way of looking at things out there.
In her speech, Nadia Hijab stressed the need for strong Palestinian leadership in order to effect compromise. It seems like they have already compromised enough, an audience member commented. Can you please clarify what is left to compromise, she asked.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, I think there should be a strong Palestinian leadership, you know, in and of itself, not specifically for the purpose of compromise. But if you're going to have a peace agreement, there are going to have to be compromises. And I couldn't agree with you more that the Palestinians have already compromised enormously on the size of the land that they're willing to live on. But there's going to have to be some discussion about where the Palestinian refugees and exiles, of whom there are nearly, 5 million around the world. So what's going to become of them? Where are they going to go? How will they go? And unless you have, can they go home? How will they go home? Are they going to get compensation? You know, unless you have a strong Palestinian leadership that can say authoritatively to the Palestinian people, look, we can get this, this, and this, and trust us, we can deliver. You know, and by the way, we can't get 100% on this one. then you're not going to be able to move forward. But I think on the question of the refugees, that is going to be one that the Palestinian leadership will have to face, and that the Israelis will have to face, because Palestinians want to go home, and it's, you know, the Israelis have, according to what I understand from some of the secret negotiations, at various points, the Israelis have said, okay, fine, we'll take 100,000 back, and you know, but then publicly they say we're not going to take a single one back, and so that's an issue that has to be thrashed out.
Are there some things the United States can do to help Israel make things happen? An audience member asked.
Yes, I mean, I'm afraid that the things the United States can do to help Israel would fall under the category of tough love. I mean, it's basically got to say to Israel, look, you've been saying now for 16 years that you're going to stop the settlements, you're going to remove the outposts, this has got to happen. And if it doesn't happen, there are going to be these consequences, you know. And so it really, the U.S. has to somehow tie its aid to Israel to a freeze and a beginning of dismantlement of the settlements. And it has to look into the groups in the United States that are sending private money to the settlers. And that's why I say the U.S. actually needs the European Union to work with them on this and to do some of this, you know, tough love act themselves. So that's what they're going to have to do because, you know, all of this is against the law. So, I mean, the U.S. Israel should simply withdraw to the 1967 borders if it's going to follow the law. Again, if it's going to follow the law, it should allow back and compensate the Palestinian refugees. I mean, they have the right of return under international law. But since the law is not being, and in fact, when Israel became a member state of the United Nations, it said it would abide by the resolutions that provided for the right of the Palestinians to return. But none of that's been implemented. So to make things happen that haven't been happening, there's going to be a need for, well, let's just call it tough love.
Can you speak more about the wall in Israel and where the money is coming from to build it? Has the United States government or corporate America contributed to the construction of this wall? An audience member asked.
Yes, thanks. I mean, the budget for the wall is provided by the Israeli state. I mean, that's the fact that Israel gets about $3 billion a year in aid from the United States makes it possible for Israel then to divert, you know, some of its own monies to construct that wall. There are some American companies that are complicit in the construction of the wall or in settlements in the occupied territories. I mean, for example, Motorola is involved in establishing security outposts in the occupied territories. And as you mentioned yourself, Caterpillar. And in fact, some church groups in the United States, some mainstream churches like the United Methodists, like the Presbyterians, are beginning to look at their investments in order to divest from companies in the United States that are doing business in a way that supports the occupation.
Last, an audience member asked Nadia Hijab to talk more about the Jews in Israel from Muslim countries. What are they doing now? Are they maintaining their language and culture? Are they a source of contention or possible compromise? He asked.
These are all very good questions. I mean, it's they are a very sizable population group in Israel, I believe. I'm not sure if they outnumber the Ashkenazi Jews. I believe that they're known as Sephardi Jews because they are the Jews and the Muslims used to be together in Spain and then were kind of chased out of Spain together. And so a lot of them are the ones that ended up were living in the Arab world and then are now in Israel. They are among, politically, unfortunately, they're on the right, a lot of them, because they are economically less well off than the Ashkenazi Jews who came from Europe. who control most of, you know, the economy and the power. And so people in poorer groups tend to be more conservative and tend to want an even poorer group to feel superior to, which happens in this case to be the Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel. I don't know to what extent. I think many of them are, by the way, working, I mean, with the Palestinian Arabs towards equality and have written out, spoken out about the discrimination they experience and they face. So you have that. I'm just reminded when I was listening to you of the taxis I take when I visit, and a few times I've had Israeli Jewish taxi drivers, and when they find out I'm Arab, they're delighted because, you know, they're either from Iraq or from Morocco, and they want to relate to someone who's Arab. Morocco, which had a large and thriving Jewish community, a few years ago, encouraged its Jewish community to come back, and about 10, 15 years ago. And there's a lot of movement between the Jews of North African descent and their, you know, their original homes in North Africa.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with Nadia Hijab, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies in Washington, D.C. She responded to questions from the audience following her speech entitled Palestinian-Israeli Peace, An Agenda for the Next President, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on October 10, 2008. For links to any of the websites noted by Nadia Hijab in today's program, you can go to our website, KSKA.org. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit KSKA.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show or share your comments with us and other listeners. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.